concerns Ethiopia.
Wind blew. The great solitary trees in the fields swayed and beat their branches together, cracking their thin twigs so that they were scattered on the ground. The snow came down steadily all night and all the next day and every day. There seemed to be no end to it. Day after day it snowed. The house was an island in a sea of whiteness. The baby would come soon, the nurse told everybody. There was no chance to get the doctor through the drifts, but she could manage. The fires were heaped with wood and coal, wood from the store in the barn, coal from the great open coal place where the ivy tods leaned over the walls.
We present Elizabeth Proud in The Snow Baby by Dennis Judd. A portrait of the life and world of the children's writer Alison Utley, who was born 100 years ago on December the 17th, 1884. The narrator is Sean Barrett.
So I was born in this wild storm with deep snow on the ground and cattle shut in their houses and horses in the stable. I was wrapped in a long flannel nightdress over the thin lawn nightgown that babies wore and laid in a drawer to sleep. There was no cradle, and the green wooden crib provided for me was too big for a baby. The old nurse took the deepest drawer from the polished mahogany chest of drawers and lined it with blankets. I was a snow baby. A lucky baby, they said. Born just before Christmas in the great storm. Snow was part of my life, and it would always attract me and bring magic to me. Magic of fairy tale and snow crystals and miracles of ice flowers on the windows.
Alison Utley was born Alice Taylor. She died in May 1976, aged 91. Although her first book, The Squirrel, The Hare, and The Little Grey Rabbit, was not published until she was 43, she had become a prolific author by the end of her long life. Her children's stories, country reminiscences, and books of essays have held captive a large and devoted readership of children and adults for more than half a century. The inspiration for much of her best writing was derived from her country childhood at Castletop Farm on the southern borders of the Derbyshire Peak District. She was the daughter of Henry Taylor, the sturdy representative of a long line of tenant farmers, and of his second wife, Hannah. She had one younger brother, Harry. Susan Dickinson was for many years Alison Utley's editor at the publishers Collins.
Possibly the magic of the books is that they're stories about country people that to a certain extent reflect Alison's own country childhood. They're possibly based on people she knew as a child. The settings are isolated, the characters are very dependent on each other for all their amusements and entertainments, their news. They have a fantastic child appeal because of this tight community. Basically, of course, she was writing the books for her little boy and therefore wanted to tell him in a childlike way the sort of things that she had enjoyed herself as a child, what had given her pleasure.
Alison Utley herself was recorded in 1970 when she was 86.
I think I was a very eager little girl, fearfully
in love with everything I saw. And I always loved animals. We had many animals. We had horses and cows and pigs and sheep. And we knew all of them by name. And we were very kind to them. And I looked on them as brothers and sisters almost. And I've always felt very much loving animals. And it was a very, very beautiful spot. It was a well-known beauty spot, our old house. And we lived there for 200 years. Everything was old-fashioned in the house. And all the furniture was what you call antique, because it was all very ancient and very beautiful. I've written about it in The Country Child and in lots of books. I always wanted to tell people about my old home, you see.
She had a very lonely childhood, because the farm where she was brought up was so isolated. And yet, I get the impression from reading books like The Country Child that it was a very happy childhood.
Happy though her childhood undoubtedly was, Alison Utley also remembered the sadness of her early years.
I was miserable enough as a little child. I used to be frightfully sad when people were cross with me. And lots of little things used to make me very unhappy. But then I got fields and woods to go to where I could recover. Fields are my comforters in sorrow. They spread their benediction before me, and their serenity heal my scars. I had only to run down a slope, drop to the ground, and lie on the soft grass to be helped to bear all the indignities and insults of childhood from grown-up people.
Writing in her diary in April 1963, Alison Utley remembered that in her childhood,
I always felt I was a changeling child. A bit of fairy got into me at Castle Top.
In the same diary entry, she compared herself to the girl she had just seen portrayed in a film on television.
The girl reminds me intensely of myself when a child. Such eagerness and seriousness and longing. But my life was more romantic, with its fields and woods and rocky hills, and less happy with the presents she got on her birthday and the petting from her father. Just as vivid a life, and the ghosts and the appearance as if in a dream that I have.
Peter Dusautoy, who knew her well when he was her editor at Faber, is clear as to the appeal of her country books.
I think undoubtedly the appeal is nostalgia, looking back to an earlier and simpler age, and also the appeal to town city dwellers to have the picture of the country described to them so vividly and at first hand. Alison, after all, knew country life very thoroughly from her own farm days.
Her vivid imagination was fired by the most ordinary things at Castle Top Farm.
There was a little white gate into the kitchen garden, and I thought that was the gate through which Adam and Eve were escorted into the great outside. No rabbit was allowed in the garden, though, the Garden of Eden. There was no room for a rabbit. It was killed if it went there. And all the fields I knew very well indeed, of course. I'd just been brought up with them. And they were all connected with heaven.
The livestock of the farm was cared for kindly. Wild animals were also the subject of intense interest and a source of pleasure. She remembered the hares dancing.
They used to come in the top pasture, which is a long way from our house over a great hill. They liked that. And my father told us now and then that he'd watched a hare dance. It did dance, you know. It really danced about. I've seen it dance just like a human being, go round and round. And we were absolutely thrilled. We all ran if we saw hares dancing. We all ran indoors and told everybody.
In 1891, Alison Utley went to Lee Board School. The last part of the 2-mile walk home took her through a wild and, as she saw it, threatening wood.
I was frightened every day, but there was no other way to go to school. It was a very, very good school, but I was frightened in the wood. I was frightened of something kind of ghostly, something that people wouldn't understand, because if there were people with me, I didn't mind a bit.
This daily walk through the terror of the wood left a lasting impression.
Woods have always been haunted places to me, filled with life, with spectres and goblins. Places of great beauty, where beauty struggles against the dangerous elements, the unknown, invisible creatures. These invisible ones lived in the wood, and stepped into sight, appearing out of the trees, hiding, ready to spring, watching with many eyes. I was not timid. I faced many small, ordinary dangers without fear. The savage bull, the horse that attacked people, the strange beggars and tramps who came out of shadows to beg at the farm. But the denizens of the wood were different. They were not human. They were part animal, werewolves or foxes, which had human qualities, giants and dwarves and fairy tale legends, ghosts and spirits from the Bible. All the woods were not the same. Some were comforting, happy families of trees, where rabbits played and birds sang. They welcomed a child and allowed the shafts of sunlight to pierce the air and shine down upon her. They had no sinister trees to catch her by the hair and shut her up in their green depths forever.
To help her through her daily ordeal, she used sometimes to bribe other children to walk with her.
I think that was my first storytelling. I used to bribe other children with the promise of a story. And I told lots of stories, made them up as I just went along.
At 12, Alison won a scholarship to Lady Manners School at Bakewell, to which she travelled by train, and where she excelled at science and maths and enjoyed Latin. She also played for the school cricket team, developing a passion for the game that was to make her a regular spectator at Old Trafford when she later lived near Manchester. In 1975, she recalled her first excitement in the physics laboratory.
I remember using a test tube. I thought it was a marvellous thing.
To Alison Utley's love of nature and her feeling for magic and mystery was now added a lifelong devotion to science. It was, at first sight, a curious mixture of interests, but one she found no difficulty in reconciling, as she explained in an interview published in The Times in December 1959, entitled Poetic Scientist.
My subject is physics, the poetic science. There is too much applied science nowadays. Everything has life. If there is one thing science teaches you, it is that. Once you have grasped the structure of the atom, you realize that everything is alive, even metals, minerals, so-called inanimate objects. So you see, even Sam Pig and Grey Rabbit are alive in their own fashion. Life is a many-sided thing.
At the age of 18, she capped her successful school career by winning a scholarship to Manchester University. Alison discovered the joys of the Halle Orchestra and the city's art galleries. She also enjoyed the companionship of other intelligent, industrious, and lively young women, and at Ashburn Hall's cocoa evenings would join in the animated discussion of books and plays and issues like women's suffrage. At Ashburn Hall, she became friendly with a young woman reading classics, Gertrude Utley, who later introduced her to her brother James, a graduate in civil engineering, and with whom she thought Alison at least had a scientific training in common. The Utley family lived in modest affluence in Bowden, on the outskirts of Manchester. George Harry Utley, the father of five children, including James and Gertrude, was a free-thinking man who had made his money out of dealings in the Manchester cotton trade. To be admitted on terms of equality into such a family was a new experience for Alison. She seems to have compensated for some of her early unease by displaying an inappropriate intellectual assertiveness. Certainly, some members of the family considered her to be somewhat overbearing. She was tactful enough, however, eventually to suggest that because James already had a sister called Alice, she should henceforth be known as Alison. She graduated with a third-class honours degree in physics in 1906, the only woman so to graduate in that year at Manchester University. In 1907, she completed a year's training for the teacher's certificate at Cambridge, and later in that year was appointed junior science mistress at the London County Council Secondary School in Fulham. During these years, she became interested in socialism, distributing pamphlets and meeting early Labour pioneers like Keir Hardie and Philip Snowden. In 1911, when she left London to marry James Utley, the emotional wrench was great.
I felt as if I'd left behind part of my heart. I went to live in the depths of the country, where there was no talk of socialism. I had torn myself away from London, feeling as if it were a beloved country village where I had many places and friends. Life had gone full circle.
By this time, the apparently paradoxical interests and passions that were later to sustain Alison Uttley as a writer were already in evidence. She had studied the complexities of atomic physics, yet felt firmly rooted in the rocky soil of her Derbyshire home. She believed animistically in the life force inherent in plants, trees, stones, and streams, yet she had conducted formal scientific experiments. She had also precognitive dreams about what examination questions she would face. She was devoted to the science of astronomy, yet remained throughout her life mystically excited by the constellation of Orion. She had also become very interested in the power of dreams, and was convinced that during sleep, the unconscious mind could move back and forth in time. It was no accident that one of her most successful books was to be A Traveller in Time. In the first years following her marriage, when she had her only child, John, in 1914, she made no attempt to become a writer. At university, the world of science had been totally absorbing.
I didn't care a button about English, and I couldn't bother to go down and do this dull English subject. It was much more exciting to do the scientific work. I never thought of writing a book. I didn't know anybody who'd written a book, and I didn't realize they were written. I thought they were created in a way. And then later on, I wanted to write, but I never knew how to set about it. Once I sat with pencil and paper in a bedroom at my old home, determined to write the feelings that flooded my mind before I went away. I could not do it. I don't think I ever realized one could write a book until I saw a typewriter, and that cheered me up.
It was not until 1929 that Heinemann published Alison Uttley's first book, The Squirrel, the Hare, and the Little Grey Rabbit. Although the book was the first of the enormously successful and profitable Little Grey Rabbit series, of which over 5 million have been sold, it went largely unremarked at the time. She had also been writing a book of autobiographical reminiscence, which was later published as The Country Child. She was deeply hurt when this intensely personal book was scorned by her husband James as being too childish even to read. It was also rejected by publishers.
I felt awfully fed up. Nobody would accept it. And then my husband died, and I was left without any money and with my son at public school. So I sent off this book again on the chance to Fabers, who accepted it.
The publication of The Country Child in 1931 launched Alison Uttley upon her career as a successful writer. Books flowed from her pen, tales for children, books of essays, novels, and plays. By the end of her long writing career, she had written 22 books for adults and almost 100 books for children. The great majority of her children's books are about animals: Little Grey Rabbit and Company, Sam Pig, Tim Rabbit, The Little Red Fox, and the mice, Snug and Serena.
I write much more about animals. I think they have such a raw deal, and I think they're very faithful and very, very patient. In the Little Grey Rabbit books, Grey Rabbit is supposed to be rather a good little person. Not too good, but quite fun, and the head of the family. Hare, as every child who writes is pleased to tell me, Hare is bold and rather bad, but all the little boys like Hare. Squirrel is very conceited. I brought out that trait in little girls, who are very often rather like that. In these little books, I always tried to give some specially English touch of country life which might be forgotten.
True to this philosophy, later editions of the Grey Rabbit books, beautifully illustrated by Margaret Tempest and then by Catherine Wigglesworth, carried a foreword which told readers,
"You must understand that Grey Rabbit's home had no electric light or gas, and even the candles were made from pith of rushes dipped in wax from the wild bee's nest, which Squirrel found. Water there was in plenty, but it did not come from a tap. It flowed from a spring outside, which rose up from the ground and went to a brook. Tea did not come from India, but from a little herb known very well to country people who once dried it and used it in their cottage homes. The country ways of Grey Rabbit were the country ways known to the author."
Susan Dickinson is convinced of the enduring appeal of these stories.
I think as the years go by, the Little Grey Rabbit books, at any rate, will be more and more appreciated for what they show us about life in the country at the turn of the century, which was very, very different from country life today. And the characters that she portrayed in those little books, they're all so clearly defined. They've got such strong traits, each one of them, that I think that they'll go on being read, oh, for another 100 years anyway.
The three main characters of the Grey Rabbit books reflect different aspects of Alison Utley's own personality. Its combination of love of home and homemaking, her pride in her intellectual capacity and her achievements as an author, and her strong sense of her own worth.
A long time ago, there lived in a little house on the edge of a wood, a hare, a squirrel, and a little grey rabbit. The hare, who wore a blue coat on weekdays and a red coat on Sundays, was a conceited fellow. The squirrel, who wore a brown dress on weekdays and a yellow dress on Sundays, was proud. But the little rabbit, who always wore a grey dress with white collar and cuffs, was not proud at all. Every morning, when the birds began to twitter, she sprang out of her bed in the attic and ran downstairs to the kitchen. She went into the shed for firewood and lighted the fire. Then she filled her kettle with clear water from the brook which ran past the door, just beyond the garden.
Another of Alison Utley's most endearing creations, Sam Pig, also sprang from her country experiences.
I was very fond of Sam Pig, and children like Sam Pig very much too. They always ask for another little story of Sam Pig.
Peter du Sautoy is in no doubt as to the most successful of her children's books published by Faber.
The Sam Pig books. Sam Pig is like a little boy, really, rather mischievous and getting up to all sorts of adventures and so on. I used to think that he was, in a way, her son, so to speak. John, fictionalized.
Alison Utley recalled in a BBC television program at the age of 91 how the pigs at Castletop Farm lived in some style.
Oh, they had a palace. It was the most lovely big sty you've ever seen. I read a book about our big sty because it was 200 years old, my father said. It had been there in our ancestors' time. And all round the top of the wall that surrounded the pigsty, so it was comfortable for a little girl to walk all along this. And I used to walk all round here, calling to the pigs. The pigs never stopped talking, and I didn't either. I was one of the pigs.
Her husband's unexpected and tragic death by drowning in 1930 gave her a compelling financial justification for writing. Often lonely, with her son away at public school, she began her transformation into a full-time writer. As she grew more successful during the 1930s, she decided to leave her house at High Downs at Bowden. In 1938, she settled at Thacker's, a modest gabled house at Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire. She was an energetic and inspired gardener. She could easily visit London to spend time at the art galleries, to see her publishers, and to tempt herself at the shops. But she was also prey to much unhappiness, and frequently felt lonely and abandoned, especially after her son's marriage and his eventual move to Guernsey, where his wife came from. Alison Utley was often exasperated with those who worked for her, her gardeners and charladies. She was also frequently critical of her friends, was over-demanding of their time, and occasionally jealous if they developed close relationships with other people. Her home, though, was a constant solace, even if housework and gardening demanded a lot of her time.
She was a practical person, certainly in gardening and also to some extent in cooking, though I must say, towards the end of her life, her standards fell a little bit, I think, but still, she was a practical person, and she was interested, of course, as we know from her books, in all aspects of housework and looking after the household and guests and so on. I think she washed the sheets and things like that, which normally people don't do nowadays in towns, anyhow. And I was struck by the amount of work she did, spring cleaning and that sort of thing. That was very important to her.
To those who visited her in her professional capacity, she was often a stimulating, impressive, and kindly hostess. In 1959, when she was in her 75th year and at the height of her fame, a journalist described her as of medium height, sturdily built, her almost white hair cut short, parted in the middle, and kept in place by a simple bandeau, such as a child might wear. Indeed, the description went on, despite the evident signs of the years, were it not for the eyebrows and eyes, one might be tempted to guess that the child had changed but little. The features have retained a child's candor, coupled with a child's instinctive secretiveness. That ability to withdraw at will into a delicious storehouse of sensations and impressions which can only be savored by the taste buds of the soul, as it were, like bullseyes or aniseed balls on the tongue. But the eyebrows are thick and black, and the eyes dark and bright and knowledgeable, youthful and direct, but not a child's eyes. They do not belie the serenity of the rest of the face, but rather give it depth and meaning, an intellectual sanction to an intuitive simplicity. Among other visitors to her house at Beaconsfield was Susan Dickinson of Collins, the publishers of nearly all the Little Grey Rabbit books.
She had this house, rather like the little house on the edge of the wood. It was filled with memories. Every single available surface was covered with little figurines and little boxes. And then down at the bottom of the garden were the dogs' graves, where you were taken and shown these little standing stones by the bluebell wood. And of course it was always a Scotty. It was a lovely place to visit, and I always enjoyed going to see her very much. And she was such a stimulating person to talk to.
I always thought one had to get sort of slightly attuned to her atmosphere, her way of thinking, her way of life, because she was rather an extraordinary person. You had to get used to the idea that here was somebody who really did believe in fairies and had this passion for miniature things. Her long sitting room, which was a very remarkable room, was crowded with objects she'd collected, including, of course, her very remarkable collection of Dutch and Flemish painters, all of them small, incidentally, and things like snuff boxes, patch boxes, little ornaments of various kinds.
Very necessary, emotionally, to Alison Uttley was the wood at the bottom of her garden.
Her house was in a perfectly ordinary suburban road, but not only did it have the very long sitting room, which was the important feature of the house, but it also had a very nice garden, and at the end of the garden, quite a long bit of woodland, which had been kept when the houses were built. And this was very important to her, because her dogs could play in it, and she had watched the trees, very big trees there were, and there were all sorts of wildflowers growing in the wood, which she loved. And this, I always thought, was something she was very lucky to have, really, in Beaconsfield, which is, after all, a suburban town.
She was a very professional author. The manuscript arrived very clearly typed, and it was quite obvious that she knew exactly how she wanted it presented, and we would read it and go back to her with any small suggestions we might have, and she either agreed with them or not, and then we send it to Margaret Tempest, who told us what she would like to illustrate, and we then went back to Alison Uttley. Yes, she was quite an easy author to deal with, but if she had made up her mind about something and we didn't agree with her, then she would dig her toes in quite firmly.
I don't know that any author is very easy to deal with, and perhaps they shouldn't be, but I got on very well with her. I was really responsible for looking after her books of essays, not so much her children's books, and I did work closely with her over those, and I found it quite easy to do that. The illustrations for the essays by Tunnicliffe were extremely important, and it was a great pleasure to her that he went on illustrating them right to the end, and was always the illustrator. The illustrations for the other books were not all that remarkable, and I think they depended on the stories rather than the illustrations, whereas in the Grey Rabbit books, of course, the illustrations were extremely important. But Tunnicliffe became a great friend of hers, and they corresponded about the illustrations to be used, and she would suggest things, and he would send sketches to her to ask whether they really were representative of what she wanted to explain.
Peter du Sautoy particularly admired her ability to blend together science and magic, plain country things and dreams, mystery and reality.
The great characteristic of her writing is that she could do that, really. And it is a very remarkable fact about her that she was friendly on one hand with Professor Alexander, not a scientist, but a philosopher of great standing, and also with Walter de la Mare. She was very, very fond of Walter de la Mare, and they used to write to each other and visit each other quite frequently. And she would share with him her interest in dreams, in the nature of time, for example. And that I think, is a very important feature of her writing and of her general attitude to life. I remember, incidentally, that she had quite difficult reaction to the first arrival of men on the moon. On the one hand, she was fascinated by the achievement of arriving on the moon. On the other hand, she really thought that the moon had been violated in some way. The goddess had been invaded.
Alison Uttley was gifted and complicated. She could be tough in business matters, and she was eventually estranged from Margaret Tempest, the illustrator of the earlier Little Grey Rabbit books, over the copyright for these beautiful illustrations, and over which of them had truly created the characters. She was always something of an egotist, and became very conscious of her status as a much-loved children's writer. She took her art very seriously, altering, rewriting, and retyping stories in order to obtain a perfect result.
She had this amazing ability to write beautifully. Her books can be read aloud, and you never get tired of reading them aloud, because the way she puts her words together is so lovely. As a person, there was a great deal of warmth there, but I think she often tended to hide it. It didn't come across easily, but you knew underneath that there really was this very warm personality.
Heaven is here, if we did but see it. So I describe what I see this latish afternoon in the garden. A chaffinch walked nearly to my feet as I sat here on the lawn. Long shadows on the rich green grass, the rustle of the trees, now in the wood, now in the plum tree. Blue and pink petunias are nearly the only flowers, with a cluster or two of roses and a little root of yellow snapdragons. The oak tree is pale olive green against the rich, heavier green of the beech. The light falls radiating on the lead figure, his face, hair, his right arm, his left leg, and upon the silver dolphin.
She was no easy sentimentalist, and despite the charm and whimsy of some of her writing, there is much in it that is down to earth, clear-eyed, and even violent. Writing was for her both a creative act and a form of therapy, compensating for a variety of disappointments and discomforts. She was prone to depression and developed, particularly during the second half of her life, a variety of ailments, some of them apparently psychosomatic in character. She was clearly only partially fulfilled in her private and emotional life, while at the same time triumphantly successful in her career as a writer. Yet, at the root of her success, there is a pervading sense of tragedy and loss. Much of her writing attempts to compensate for that loss. The lost love of long-dead parents. The loss of the pastoral solitude of childhood that she associated with Castle Top. The loss of her husband, prematurely dead. The loss of her only son, married and at the end living far away in Guernsey. The loss of a pattern of English rural life that was already doomed at her birth. But Alison Uttley also enjoyed life. She found her writing success deeply gratifying. Although she was oversensitive to criticism, and when she first moved down to Beaconsfield, was liable to prowl the counters of the local bookshop demanding to know why her books were not displayed there. She loved music, art, and ideas. She found sustenance and renewal in the seasonal rhythms of the natural world. She also observed the festivals of the Church of England and of English life. Chief among these by far, because she associated it with the month of her own birth, was Christmas.
At Christmas time, everything traditional had to be done. There had to be Christmas trees and decorations and candles and lights and everything. And Christmas cards. I used to get her cards specially printed for her using one of the Tunnicliffe illustrations from the latest book of essays. And she would have this ready in good time to send out about 100 or 200 cards to people all over the world, actually. And it was something very important to her that these traditional representations should be carried out at Christmas time.
Alison Utley's love of Christmas shines like a star through the many years of her life and from the pages of her books. The preparations that attended her childhood Christmases upon her Derbyshire farm at the end of the last century were remembered with a particular fondness through the Garland family, who represent Alison's own family in The Country Child.
A few days before Christmas, Tom Garland and Dan took a billhook and knife and went into the woods to cut bunches of scarlet-berried holly. Tom cut a bough of mistletoe from the ancient hollow hawthorn which leant over the wall by the orchard, and thick clumps of dark buried ivy from the wall. Indoors, Mrs. Garland and Susan polished and rubbed and cleaned the furniture and brasses so that everything glowed and glittered. They decorated every room, from the kitchen through the hall, which was a bower of green, to the two parlours, which were festooned and hung with holly and boughs of fir, and ivy berries dipped in red raddle left over from sheep marking. On Christmas Eve, fires blazed in the kitchen and parlour and even in the bedrooms. Flames roared up the chimneys as Dan carried in the logs and Becky piled them on the blaze. The wind came back and tried to get in, howling at the keyholes, but all the shutters were cottered and the doors shut.
Little Grey Rabbit also celebrated Christmas as Alison Utley remembered it.
The fire crackled in the chimney. Sweet smells filled the kitchen. The scent of the burning logs and the smell of dried lavender which hung from the ceiling and the fragrance of the green holly which Hare carried. The silver moon shone down on the white fields, making them glitter with a strange and beautiful light. The stars twinkled in the frosty air, and now and then a shooting star left a track of gold across the heavens. Up the lane came a little company, carrying rolls of music and pipes of straw. Their tiny feet made crackles in the snow, and they talked softly as they walked up to the closed door of Grey Rabbit's house.
Alison Utley remembered the visits of the Wassailers, or Guisers, as they were called in Derbyshire.
And then, on Christmas Eve, the men came from the village. They had to walk about over 2 miles in pitch dark, never a light anywhere. And they walked along the road till they came to our house. And they came up, and the dog began to bark, and we shut her in the stable. And as they came up the lane which led to our house, which was a private lane, our own lane, we could hear men singing, and it was what were called the Guisers. And what they did was to have a false nose, a big false nose, and they came and stood in the kitchen doorway, and everybody was in fits of laughter. We always had some friends with us, or somebody who'd come up to see us to keep wassailing. And then we gave them elderberry wine, which my mother had made, and which was stood in a great tin pansion on the dairy floor. And all the wassailers sang about this, singing, "Wassailing, here we come a-wassailing."
Here we come a-wassailing among the leaves a-green. Here we come a-wandering so fairly to be seen. Now is winter time, strangers travel far and near, and we wish you, send you a happy new year.
Half a dozen young men and a woman stamped their feet and entered, bringing clots of snow and gusts of sweet icy air. They stood in a row in front of the dresser and asked riddles of one another.
How many sticks go to the building of a crow's nest? None. For they're all carried.
Who was the first whistler, and what tune did he whistle?
The wind, and he whistled over the hills and far away.
'Tis an old custom, that, observed Tom Garland, as he leaned back against the comfortable cushions of the settle. But when my father was young, and his father before him, they did a play, a mumming play, with no words. Then he told stories of his childhood. How they brewed their own beer in the brew house and made their tallow dips. His grandmother sat in the chimney corner with a spinning wheel and made the very same cloth they had on the table. He told of the ghost his father met by the gate of the meadow, which never answered, but brought death to the house.
At last it was time for the child Alison to go to bed, and then the early morning excitement of finding what she had in the Christmas stocking.
I dived down all among the little things, There weren't big things, and there were no dull things like pairs of gloves and pairs of stockings or anything. There were little toys and things. And we used to put my hand right down, 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 and pulling the stocking up down to the very tiptoe, and there we found half a crown, which was gold and silver to us. Well, I know one thing that would be, and you'd never see it nowadays, a little china doll. A little doll about so big. They sold them in the village, and I loved them. I thought they were enchanting. Just this little china doll. It had a little china head.
And then there was the pleasure of the Christmas table.
The potatoes were balls of snow. The sprouts green as if they'd just come from the garden, as indeed they had, for they too had been dug out of the snow not long before. The turkey was brown and crisp. The stuffing smelled of summer and the herb garden in the heat of the sun. As for the plum pudding, with its spray of red berries and shiny leaves and its hidden sixpence, it was the best they had ever tasted. There was no dessert, nor did they need it, for they sipped elderberry wine, mixed with sugar and hot water in the old pointed wine glasses, and cracked the walnuts damp from the trees.
After tea, their way lit by their best lantern, Alison, with her family, went to evening service at the church.
The lights dazzled their eyes as they walked up the aisle. Lamps hung from the walls, and every dark holly leaf was a candle, every scarlet berry a farthing dip. The windows alone had lost their radiance and stood back behind the colour and warmth which filled the church, almost visible to the child's eye, searching the air for invisible things. For God on the altar, and angels floating above the choir, the music beating its wings in the high, dark beams of the roof, and for goodness and mercy running hand in hand down the chancel. Everybody sang mightily, the deep voices of the old men and the tiny piping voices of children, overpowering the organ and compelling it to a slow grandeur in While Shepherds Watched and Hark the Herald Angels Sing and Lead Kindly Light. The old words rang out bravely, and the scent of bear's grease and peppermint balls filled the air like incense.
Sam Pig, like Grey Rabbit, took delight in the magic of Christmas, calling his brothers and sister and Brock the Badger to look at the Christmas tree.
They stared in astonishment at the small fir tree, all hung with pretty things. There were sugar pigs with pink noses and curly tails of string, and sugar watches with linked chains of white sugar, and chocolate mice. There were rosy apples and golden oranges, and among the sweet dainties were glittering icicles and hoarfrost crystals. "Where has it come from? How did it grow here?" they asked, and they turned to Badger. "Is it magic?" they asked. "Will it disappear? Is it really real?" "Hush," whispered Grey Rabbit. "It's a magical tree, a tree from fairyland growing in our wood." "It's a Christmas tree," replied Mole in his soft, mysterious voice. "It's for all the birds and beasts of the woods and fields. They will see it from afar and come here." Across the snowy fields padded little dark creatures, all filled with curiosity to see the glowing lights in the trees. Some were thin, and some were lame, and many were poor, for it had been a hard winter. "Help yourselves," cried Mole, waving his short arms. "It is Christmas. Eat and drink and warm yourselves. Take away as much as you want for your storerooms." Then every little creature ate the good food, drank the sweet honeyed ale, and carried away little baskets of meal and cakes and corn. Squirrel and Grey Rabbit climbed on the sledge, and Hare drew them over the snow. "Good night, a happy Christmas," they called as they left their friends behind.
"Hey-ho, I'm sleepy too," murmured Squirrel.
"But it has been lovely. Thank you, Grey Rabbit and Mouldiwarp and Rat and everyone, for a happy day."
She curled down under the fleecy shawl by Grey Rabbit's side. Grey Rabbit sat wide awake on the swaying sledge, and her eyes shone with happiness. "Peace on earth and mercy bright," her heart sang. And Hare ran swiftly over the frozen snow, drawing the scarlet-coloured sledge towards the little house at the end of the wood.
You've been listening to The Snow Baby by Dennis Judd, an appreciation of the writer Alison Uttley, who was born 100 years ago on December the 17th, 1884. Elizabeth Proud read the extracts from the stories and diaries and transcribed conversations, and Sean Barrett was the narrator. The voice of Alison Uttley herself was heard in recordings made for BBC Television. The producer was Alan Haydock, and there's another chance to hear The Snow Baby this coming Friday morning at 11:03 here on Radio 4. Also this week, in fact, every evening in A Book at Bedtime, you've a chance to hear Leah McKern reading extracts from his recently published autobiography, Just Resting. The eight readings are interspersed with a multitude of digressionary ruminations